Mike McGlone, Senior Commodity Strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be back. Appreciate being on.
Mike, you know, you and I have discussed commodities almost exclusively every time. And when we see things at all-time highs, like, for example, diesel right now, what does that signal to you, and how do you think about the path forward from an all-time high for such an essential commodity?
Yes. The way I look at it typically is based on the facts of, and when you say diesel, I'm just showing you the daily and average diesel price. I overlay with the diesel future. It's right now the current price is ahead of the future. And what you can see from this chart going back, we got at least 20 years here, it's a very auto-correlated chart. It typically doesn't stay up. Now, what we're doing right now is quite significant, and there's good reasons for it to stay up for a little while. The question is how long? And I look at it, if you're long or if you weren't long for this, you typically never want to buy something like crude oil or heating oil or diesel or most of the grains after they go up. It's just a question of how much higher they go before they auto-correlate and correct backwards. And the key theme I like to point out about diesel is we have a pretty significant growing glut in this country of crude oil and liquid fuel supply versus demand. Now, it's not all distillate and refined products. A lot of that's being bottlenecked by the war and the two wars and Russia cutting off exports and what's happening in the Gulf. A lot of diesel's not getting out there. But the U.S. has a decent surplus of liquid fuels and natural gas. And it's just a question of how much longer it'll be before the self-correcting mechanism kicks in. And key thing to remember about surging prices in energy is its own worst enemy, more so every day now than when it first spiked in 2008. I remember when diesel spiked and gasoline spiked. Here we have the chart of, gasoline. When it went about $4 in 2008, that really accelerated my bearish views on the stock market and everything. But gasoline, this is the number one measure for consumer sentiment. This country. And consumers are just pissed off, and they should be. And I don't think Mr. Trump seems to get it yet, but the Republicans are. So that's become so geopolitical, and there's an election in 2 months, and there's huge motivation for the party in power of the world's largest energy producer and net exporter to get these prices lower. Now, how he does it, that's a different story, but the motivation's there, and I still think that's going to happen. So I fully expect these prices, like, for instance, diesel will be lower by year. And if I show you that, I just remember the chart, I'll show you right there. But question of how high it goes. And I'm pretty sure we're getting close to those nadirs now. Some of the key indications are here. I'll show you one thing here. This is U.S. natural gas. This is the futures curve. The January contract is the one that matters, which is make this a little bit bigger so our viewers can see it. That January future natural gas, it's the apex of the futures curve. It's the one that's the highest price. It's at $3.86 right now. Last year's support was $4, and then that front contract, it was in January at the time, but February popped up to $7. Now it's back down. There's a huge glut of natural gas in this country, and that's the top source for heat, electricity, and fertilizer. Now, you're not seeing that on the tape because it's not sensational. If it doesn't bleed, it doesn't lean. But this is a great indicator of where things are going. So I fully expect what happens normally is going to kick in potentially more significantly this year, maybe even next year. It might not happen this year. It's that pump in energy prices is going to dump. But like it always does, it follows simply these things happens with recessions. Hopefully that's not the case. And oftentimes they're its own worst enemy. So I just want to point out natural gas is a great leading indicator for where we're going. And when people, it just doesn't hit the tape because that January contract, it was up 16% in the beginning of the year. And now it's down about 17% on the year. So that's why I think all the diesel, gasoline, crude oil prices are going to go. It's just we have to get through a few geopolitical little issues first. Mm-hmm.
Well, Mike, what happens if the geopolitical issues continue and or, you know, get worse? Does that not point to the direction that it could stay relatively elevated?
Of course. But it's also the headline index, Tom, and I enjoy mentioning before the show, there's certain avenues we can get through. I can be completely honest, and that's what I completely do. When I get asked to do hits on TV and radio at Bloomberg and other instances, for one key subject, it's almost always either a peak or a trough. And I've been getting asked a real lot about diesel and gasoline and gas oil and energy lately. No one's mentioning natural gas because it's not doing anything. But those are usually good signals. So we're about as bad as it gets right now. And just question how much worse is it going to get? For instance, this war, Mr. Trump's war now, has become quite bad for him. It's the last exact opposite of what he expected. I'm sure he expected full unconditional surrender in 2 weeks. And the U.S. military has still not been able to eliminate the offensive capabilities of Iran. That's a shocker. I never thought that was happening. Completely wrong. I figured our military at least figure that out and have the capability to do that, but hasn't done that. So it's about as bad as it gets. Plus the war heating up in Ukraine, with the Ukraine hitting a lot of refiners in Russia. But here's a key thing that's happening: is we have record-setting production in the world's largest energy producer, the U.S. Crude oil, liquid fuels, natural gas, all hitting records. Canada's very close. Argentina, Venezuela, it's on the way, it's getting there. Brazil and Guyana are all setting records. See what's happening? That shift that was happening to happen before this war in Iran to the Western Hemisphere becoming the price maker status in energy is accelerating. And there's an election in 2 months, and U.S. is a pretty significant amount of net exports of crude oil, liquid fuel, natural gas. So I'm not saying they're going to cut off exports, but when desperate politicians get desperate, significant things happen. And there's ways around that. So overall, in the big picture, long term, this is a reversion waiting to happen. It's just a question of when and how and from what levels. And the bottom line, Tom, that hasn't happened yet is virtually always when we've had the bottom in, let's say, the price of gasoline for the last 20, I just want to share this chart again. The last 20 years or so, the price in gasoline has always bottomed right around 2. I'm not showing that in that picture here, but almost every single time this gasoline price has bottomed, the stock market has had a swoon. 2008, 2020, 2015, 16, it dropped, 2008. And here we are, stock market's at a record high. It doesn't seem to care. The key theme is it's so expensive now. That's your next potential trigger for normal post-inflation deflation and to pressure all these prices. And one thing that can make that happen is crude oil continue going up. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, when we think about the crack spread, what it costs for a barrel of refined diesel versus a barrel of crude oil, that spread has never been bigger. But when those margins are so big, you have extra capacity to, you know, to the extent that it's available, coming into the market. So, you know, is that a big part of this mean reversion? Is this overproduction and kind of catching up to producers trying to take advantage of those record margins?
Yeah, well, they're definitely profiting. Just think of what the quote I heard a little while ago is, maybe Saudi Arabia's exports have been curtailed, but the price of crude oil is up 62% from before. So. And we hear a lot of other countries all finding workarounds. But I want to show you a chart on that and point out where I think it's happening. This is just a matter of a cycle and how far it goes and where it stops. And just the fact we're talking about crude oil right now, $92 a barrel, which was first traded in 2007, is an indication of where we are. Energy prices don't stay up. And back then, the U.S. is a significant net importer. And this is what's changed. And this is what's accelerating also with this proliferation of technology replacing crude oil and fossil fuels. So what I show you here is that same chart, diesel's at a record high, $5.90 in this country. Right before this war, was around $3.75. It was heading lower. It was just a key level. $3.75 was a key level. The key theme is the last time it broke down below $3.75, the U.S. was a net importer of around 5 million barrels a day of crude oil and liquid fuels. Now we're on price for net export of 4 million barrels a day. You see the trade there? But also what I show you in this same chart, which so much is significant, is if you put that Treasury long bond, the yield on the same chart as the per gallon price of diesel, it's the same chart until recently. Now they're all being pulled higher. You see how significant this is? This is part of the reason Mr. Messon's coming and started buying bonds. And about the same time, the U.S. is selling crude oil by releasing from the SPR. I think that's a good trade to be on top of, particularly as we get to midterms. But this is how geopolitically significant, but this is how the world's changed. The U.S. is a significant net energy surplus producer. This is a short-term blip, and it's just going to accelerate this process of U.S. exporting more. So this number I show you right now is around 4 million barrels a day. That's U.S. alone. Add Canada in that, that's around 8 million barrels a day. There's only one force that's going to stop this surplus of supply versus demand from just these two countries, which is the apex of supply from the Western Hemisphere, is lower prices. Otherwise, that just keeps going up until it lower prices. So I will still make the call. In 2022, on the way down, I started saying that crude oil's low price cure is around $40 a barrel. Now, I'm going to accelerate that partly because since that's happened, we've reached all-time, almost 100-year highs in U.S. stock market cap GDP, quarter-century highs in U.S. stock market to debt, which is very important. We have the U.S. stock market trading about 40% above its 200-week moving average right before we went to the volatility season. That's never been a good time to buy the market. You see all the twists there? Just a few little triggers, and all this starts to hit towards normal post-inflation, deflation. Just a question of when and what trigger and how far it goes. And this could be the big one. And gold is giving me the signals for that, and I can show you that in a little bit. But if we, you know, we can stick on energy all you want, but right now I view this as a short-term blip in a normal cycle. And the key thing to remember is, okay, the cracks are showing up in diesel's a record high. And crude oil is the same price as it first traded in 2007. So that's how wide it is. But what does that mean? Is we don't, none of us really consumes crude oil, but we consume diesel and gasoline. So it's curtailing that demand, and it's increasing that supply, certainly in the Western Hemisphere. It's just once we work out these nuances of these wars that it'll be straightened out. In the meantime, how long it takes, I don't know if I agree with Mr. Besson saying that the Gulf's going to be redundant, not really matter in 2 years, but there's workarounds. And that's the key thing we've learned, like, since COVID, is never underestimate human ingenuity. And look what happened in 2022. Crude oil popped up to 130. And then it was trading 55 before this war. It was just hovering on the U.S. cost of production. This high year, so far this is 120. U.S. cost of production is still around $55 a barrel. And yet we're producing much more in just a matter of time. And countries like Venezuela are going to be doubling their production. They're up 30% year over year right now on crude oil production.
Mike, how much has the export out of Venezuela helped the U.S. situation? And how does that heavy crude blend with the U.S. refineries? You know, you hear so much that it's not of much use because especially the producers or the refiners in the Gulf can't really use it. They're not set up for it. So how does that play into the picture here?
I think that's part of it. I look at it more in the macro. That's getting into the weeds of basically they were producing around 900,000 barrels a day. Now they're close in the 1.2 million, so up about 30%. In, I think it was 2018, maybe 17, they're 2.5 million barrels a day. So they're going to go back there, just a matter of time. But yeah, it's a kind of barrels make a difference, but overall it's the macro that matters. We always find ways of refineries to do it, to refine the different types, different grades of crude. And that to me is more nuanced and not matter. Now, if they were exporting or producing around 10 million barrels a day, it would matter. Right now, it's only around one. Like I said, U.S. and Canada, their surplus is around 8 million barrels a day. But it's the trend in the macro that matters. Increase in supply.
Okay. So you
and have significantly declining demand. I want to make one more point. The key thing we're seeing happen is that declining demand from China. Some of us, you know, that was somewhat expected. But what's happening is China has a deficit of fossil fuels and a surplus of technology. They're just shifting over that technology and exporting it to the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Mike, when we were on that chart, you had T-bills on there. And you're saying that the T-bills are likely to reverse after this type of high as well. How does that play into this appetite, the world's appetite for U.S. debt at this time?
Yes, this is one of my favorite topics. I'm glad you went there. It's actually the T-bond. I have a bit of an affliction for the T-bond because I started in that trading pit in Chicago in the 1980s. But also the Treasury long end is the essence of investment in the entire planet. For here's your riskless investment. Here's what you get. Everything else better beat that on a risk-adjusted basis. Right now, you're getting on that U.S. Treasury bond a 5.25 yield. That's the highest on a year-end basis. We end the year here since 2001. You know, it's also the highest since 2001. The U.S. stock market relative to debt And why is debt important? Because people say T-bond yields are going up because of debt. Yeah, that's part of it. Mostly it's inflation, inflation expectations, partly because the stock market's so fast, so high, we're creating so much wealth and inflation. Yeah, we have a short-term blip from energy, which we all know always goes back down. But you see that trend there? It has to be sustained. And that's why I'm pointing out the significant potential for pretty good mean reversion there. And so I always look at it right now. Right now, if we end the year here with T-bonds at 525, we'll be able to say at the end of the year, this is the highest year end since 2001. I said that same thing about U.S. stock market to debt. If we end the year here, debt's going to keep going up. We get that stock market keeps going up. It'll be the highest stock market to debt ratio two times since 2001. And crude oil, we end the year here above 80. Right now it's at 92. 80 was the close in 2022. We'll be able to say it's the highest crude oil price since 2013, right before the shale revolution kicked in. Will we be able to make all those profound statements at the end of this year? I think that's unlikely. Part of the reason to just question what will make those things go. Remember, first thing that can make everything go lower is just crude oil reverting back down to the 70. That's 70 is high volume price for the last 20 years. And not even getting close to this cost of production, which it will eventually. And so that's one thing. But the number one factor to make all this inflation deflate a little is the stock market. Just having a little bit of normal volatility during the normal volatility season as we head towards a contentious midterm election year. And there's only been 2 years since 2008 that stock market's been down in a total return, S&P 500, and that's been the two midterm election years, 2018, 2022. So there's a lot going on. And I look at as we enter the fourth quarter this year, we can have trading years of a lifetime in the next few months and potential. Now, if we keep inching higher in the stock market, I have no clue what to do. It'll keep the inflation high, keeps the Fed on that tightening hammer, which they have to, because that's one thing I hear from Mr. Warsh is the markets are adjusting for me, or potentially, well, if the stock market were to go down, would solve that whole problem of the Fed having to ease, despite being Mr. Warsh being hired to cut rates. That's a bit of a oxymoron at the moment. But there's so many potential things that are just completely dependent on that stock market to keep going up. For instance, copper. If you're bullish copper, stock market has to go up. If you're bullish metals, stock market has to go up. They're complete stock puppets. If you're bullish cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, stock market has to go up. They're all stock puppets now. And that's where I view it as a trader. This is some tremendous opportunities. I just don't think we'll be able to say at the end they were at 525 in the long bond. Last year's close was 484. And that's just a little normal reversion. We'll see what it takes to get there. Mm-hmm.
Well, you mentioned copper in there, Mike. And of course, copper is basically, again, at an all-time high. And is that, you're saying that that's fully dependent on how the stock market behaves from here?
So that's the key thing is it's one of those lessons. If I keep saying the same thing, I might eventually be right. So I've been a little bit wrong in copper for a while. For one thing, reason, the key thing that worries me about copper is I overlay copper on the same scale as that 10-year note yield in China. Severe deflationary force is 1.7% compared to 4.8% U.S. But if you take the per pound price of copper in the U.S., overlay with the S&P 500, just lop off three zeros in the S&P 500. We've had same chart syndrome for about 10 years. And right now you see that price of the S&P 500 is up at equivalent of copper around 769. Right now copper is at $6.83. It's a complete sock puppet to the U.S. stock market. And it's being completely distorted by why I view copper as an accident waiting to happen. I want to show you in that next chart why I'm really concerned about copper. It's first of all, managed money net positions in that CME copper contract are 25% long. Historically, that averaged around 5. So they've been long and they've been right for most of since the market bumped above 5%, $5 last year, and stayed above. Managed money net positions have pumped up between 25 and 30% of total open interest on CME copper. Why CME copper? The center view of the universe. Now, I show you then in this chart, CME inventories of copper are now 70% of global major exchange inventories, which includes LME and the Shanghai exchange. It's never been that high. I mean, all this copper is in the U.S. Because of tariffs and Mr. Trump in U.S. CME COMEX warehouses. It's waiting for whatever's going to be the next data. Tariff's going to make it higher. Managed money net positions are net long. And I show you in this chart, copper is a complete sock puppet to the stock market. I look at that as that's an accident waiting to happen. All you need is a little bit of trigger to flush out those positions, which always happens in November and December. We always lose open interest in November and December in copper, in most futures. So people will flush out in a normal position. So they're riding the wave. But the key thing also is, not only has copper been, sock puppet to U.S. stock market, it goes up. Not today. I mean, we're recording on September 8th, and copper's up and stock market's down. Okay, well, there's always 1 or 2 day differences. But this metal, which is very stock market sensitive, has been trading about 2 to 3 times, almost 2 times the volatility of the S&P 500. So I look at it as a hedge fund ex-risk manager. If I have a guy on my desk who's been long copper and he's talking it up and how great it was, purpose of a hedge fund and hedge funds is to outperform the S&P 500 with lesser risk. Anybody who's long copper and a hedge fund, which they are, is underperforming the stock market and taking 2 times of risk. Okay, they've been outperforming for maybe a year, but for the last few years since 2023, they haven't been. So that to me is an accident, a liquidation accident waiting to happen. And bottom line, if you're bullish copper, you have to have the stock market going up. So all the fundamentals, we all get it. Electrification, decarbonization, major demand pull. I mean, that's all stuff we are known knowns. You can get in ChatGPT. It's interworkings that I try to dig into and say, yeah, this is a market you have to be very careful. And then I'll end with one key thing that's happened in the metals this year. We've had pumps, then dumps in Bitcoin, gold, silver, platinum, palladium, and iron ore. Copper might be next on the list. And then I look at the Bloomberg Industrial Metals Index, which copper is the major component of. It's up 15% in the year. S&P 500 is up 13%. You see the problem? So it's the key thing I'm worried about in commodities and metals is the metals are the only major commodity sector that's made a new high this year. I pointed out crude oil is still at the same price as 20 years ago. And it's really showing some issues. And I can dig into coppers potentially there, but certainly gold, silver, platinum, palladium potentially put in long-term peaks.
Mm-hmm. Well, you kind of started that explanation with copper about talking about the demand from China. But, as the world tries to build all these data centers and the world has this demand for copper, is it more than China that matters now in the copper picture?
Well, yes and no, but who doesn't know that? I mean, we've known this for years. Mm-hmm. It's like some people, when I hear people say really bullish things about gold and things that I pointed out 5 years ago, those are such known knowns. That's my point, is we all get that. All been pointed out, I've liked pointing out for years that copper almost always outperforms crude oil. That process should accelerate. We're getting a little blip in crude oil right now, partly because crude oil is becoming redundant and copper is the more demand pull commodity for all the electrification. AI then centers and get it. But what's happening now? Pushback on AI centers. And what's happening with the property crisis in China, former demand pull for copper. What's happening with just home housing markets in the U.S. are facing the highest interest rates and mortgage rates in like 20 years. So this is a classic, I think, potential peak market. And also the pattern I'm really worried about in copper has just been going inching up along with the stock market. So that's my point is, if this market is so bullish, if AI is so bullish, why is copper just lagging the S&P 500 and trading at a higher volatility and just going up on its back? That's my key theme. And just worried about the little trigger for a normal reversion where copper right now about $6.80 a month just right now. Maybe it gets to 7. I don't think it stays above 7 too long. And a normal reversion is back to 5 in a heartbeat.
So, Mike, when we think about, especially this time, the end of the summer doldrums, people, especially traders, are coming back to their desks, seeing how they want to rebalance to into the end of the year here. What are the potential triggers for the stock market rolling over as you see them?
That can be anything. So the key theme I like to point out is October 10th of last year marked the peak and the start of liquidation fund flush in cryptos. What was the main reason for that? One key reason, up too much. It's how it always works. I do love themes like from Lynn Alden. I'm a big fan of hers when she said nothing stops this train, and I had to publish out recently. something stops this train. It's always the same thing, prices. Prices just go up too much. And then you start getting liquidation events, and sometimes it just takes a trigger to kick that in. I don't know what that's going to be. I mean, the earnings are awesome and phenomenal, but you can just look at over the valuations. Like I said, the number one reason to own things like hard assets, like metals and precious metals like gold, silver, platinum, palladium. One of the top reasons is unstoppable debt spending. Now, U.S., and I do enjoy when people miss the facts by pointing out, they miss the complete essence of accounting when they point out one liability, the U.S. liability of deficits, and the deficits running $40 trillion. Yeah, that's a lot. It sucks. It keeps going up. But look at the number one measure of assets in this country real time. Stock market, $82 trillion. That ratio, 2.1 or so, is the highest in 20, in almost 20 years, 25 years on a year-end basis. Assets minus liabilities. And the stock market and metals, particularly gold, the whole broad metals index is the highest correlation to the stock market on a 100-day basis ever. Now, we've launched our Bloomberg All Metals Index in 1997, so that's a pretty long period. So that's the problem is right now. I see most markets are just such stock puppets. And what's it take? I don't know, but the signals are there. We're getting so stretched that we have to just be careful, not particularly in gold. I'm very concerned with gold that warned us last year. But I don't know what it takes. Key thing I can theorize is there's pretty significant deflationary forces coming out of China. They're creating some awesome technology for like next to nothing. And why? Just the fact that we have 100% tariffs on those great, you know, plug-ins and EVs from China is a sign something's going on. I mean, just looks happening with the German automobile manufacturers and the Japanese automobile manufacturers. They're all losing market share to these cheap BYDs from China. There's a potential, you know, just a normal pressure of rapidly advancing technology and cheap technologies from China pressuring a lot of the rest of the world. And tech's been leading the stock market in the U.S. for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in combination with, you know, the issues that China has, that combination of their, let's say, more efficient and cheaper goods, you see that as an overall deflationary force.
Well, absolutely. Well, it's the lesson from Yuval Noah Harari pointed out in his book, I think it was 21 Lessons of the 21st Century, the Mickey Mouse in Sorcerer's Apprentice in Fantasia, where Mickey Mouse creates the spell and he can't stop it from in the broomsticks. Scott Bessent used that analogy when he was pointing out the supply of technology and cheap things, renewables out of China. There's no self-correcting mechanism to stop this massive proliferation of cheap stuff, and which is wonderful if you're an importer, but U.S., we have to pay two times the average world price for solar panels because we have tariffs on it, and we pay a lot more for electric vehicles than much of the rest of the world because we have tariffs. But to me, that's part of a proliferation of significant deflationary forces. And what's the most inflated market on the planet? It's the U.S. stock market. So we look at key things I wanted to show, or I can show again, just point out, I want to do it right here. The number one measure, like thing that's really with copper in the middle, that's driving copper is we have pretty severe deflationary forces in China as measured by, just look at that 10-year yield. I'm a former bond trader, 1.69%. I started trading JGBs in 95 and just remember all this happened. That's a severe deflationary force in the world's second largest economy that's just massively exporting technology around the world. And what's it doing now? Now that we have a bit of a fossil fuel energy crisis, it's replacing like technology. And what's the number one measure of inflation on the planet? That's the U.S. stock market. It's, you know, 2.1 times our debt. People say debt's a lot. It's nothing. It's minuscule versus the stock market. 2.5 times GDP. That's the most on a year-end basis since 1928. People might call that the Warren Buffett model. There's the number one source of inflation. What happens? We just get a little reversion there. Not, I shouldn't say if. When. It's just going to be a question of when and from what levels. And that's the next big trade. That's a key thing I like to point out, Tom, that people are missing when they're talking about when Scott Bessent point out started buying bonds. They said, oh, we're supposed to buy gold and Bitcoin. I'm like, that was the last big trade. The time to buy gold and Bitcoin significantly was 2020. Gold dropped to like 1600 an ounce. Bitcoin dropped around 5000. The government pumped up the most, it had the biggest money pump in history, and I stuck with that was the time to buy those assets. Now it's not. Those things are at significant discounts. Now there's severe premiums, gold and Bitcoin, and we're tilting over to potentially post-inflation deflation. Now we have assets so inflated, it's just a question of what's it going to sustain it. And here's one thing I really enjoy that's really missing from first of all, how things have changed. So first, we know the Fed has to be vigilant against inflation. It's also an indication what's one of the top sources of inflation is the massive wealth creation effect. And this is also an indication how things have changed. In the past, when you're president, you wanted to boost the economy to get elected. Oh, yes, the Fed to ease. Now, President Trump's doing that, but he's not realizing by asking the Fed to ease and calling them patriots, by not, if they were to ease or to be patriots, he's basically telling the world, okay, I want Democrats to win the midterms and I want the Democrats to sweep the next election, because the number one problem is affordability, mostly for the 60% of these people in this country who identify as wage earners and who vote. And that's what's changed. So this is where we stand, and that's where the midterms are. Big deal, and I fully expect there's going to be a pretty significant sweep against the party in power unless they do something quickly to change. And they still might be sweep against them. And one way they do that, they have to get energy prices lower. And there's ways they can do that. I just don't know how extreme they're going to be.
Well, like, let's go through some of those ways that they can try to get inflation lower. Like, we've already released a ton out of the SPR, for example. Is that, you know, one of those avenues that or one of those levers that they can pull on even harder?
Yes, I do enjoy the whole nuance of, I'll just pull up this heating oil chart, of the SPR. First of all, the SPR, does Saudi Arabia need an SPR? No, people would say no. Yet the U.S. exports and has a greater surplus than Saudi Arabia. The SPR was started in 1974 by President Ford to cover 90 days of net imports. I pointed out with Canada, we have 8 million barrels a day of surplus of crude oil liquid fuels. And we are the world's largest producer of natural gas and the largest exporter of LNG. Don't need an SPR in that environment. You need it for certain things like happen now, but it's not like it used to be even for hurricanes and what's happened recently, but it's not, the facts have changed. And that's why I point out is we're not going to, this is the surplus. It's just shocking. It's just only going to continue widening unless prices make it go down. So SPR is part of it. But also I think what's happened, I really enjoyed writing about when Biden started reading from the SPR, was one of the best presidential trades in history. He released with crude oil around 100. I pointed on the forward curve at the moment. You could have covered a lot of those in the backwardation at the time and just lighten up in some of the in paper money and covered and made $5 billion. He released a total of $20 billion worth of crude oil. That's just normal inventory management. What we're doing with the curve in backwardation, where that front price is really high, you're supposed to sell into that and you replace with paper. When it's contango, you hoard the inventory and you sell forward and take revenue. It's a prudent thing to do in terms of macro inventory management, particularly when you shift from the world's largest importer to one of the world's largest energy producers and net exporters. So this SPR that matters on the planet is China. And what you've seen, I don't have the chart here now, I can show you maybe later, is what's happened in China is we've seen they've been probably released some of their SPR. But what thing they did is they've been hovering around 11 million barrels a day of imports of crude oil for, what, since 2000? Not really going up. But last year didn't make a lot of sense. And now we know why. They topped off their SPR. Some estimates put it at about 1.9 billion barrels. Now, the U.S. has dropped below 300 million barrels. We don't need it. We're not a net importer. They are. But what's also happening is they're accelerating that transition, as we pointed out earlier, of their surplus technology of replacing fossil fuels. So this is what's happening in the macro big picture. This is why it's a paradigm shift. Energy prices are not going to stay high, in my view. In fact, this is part of the acceleration to get it below the cost of production, which they usually do. That's the key thing. When you mention SPRs, you have to mention China. And by the way, we don't really know what their full numbers are, but what's happened with crude oil, with their imports actually rolling over. And here's another key fact I want to just end with, is how the technology, how the paradigm has shifted. Is we all know back in 2022, the statistic was total EV sales in China were around 10% of new vehicle sales. Now it's around 62%, depending what kind of how you define an EV. And there's plug-in EVs, which is what I have. Mine's 12 years old, by the way. But the total auto sales in China have rolled over. 12-month moving average has started rolling over before this hit. You see the trend there? That's the major incremental demand pull source for crude oil and liquid fuels on the planet. It's starting to roll over before the war, and now they're accelerating to EVs. There's this, everything you see on the screen is more short-term. Yeah, $92 a barrel can easily be $42 by this time next year. It could get to 100, but the higher it goes, the harder it falls. This is the way it works now, and I show you that in that chart. Just creating more and more supply from the U.S. and Venezuela and Argentina and Canada and Guyana and Brazil. You bring it on.
So, Mike, you mentioned earlier that gold was giving you a particular signal that you were, you know, paying attention to. What is that signal?
So I'm concerned, and by the time this hits the tape, you're going to see my headline from gold. The quote on gold is, the price of gold has declined 98% versus the S&P 500 total return over the last 100 years. So I have data goes back to right the end of 2026, beginning of 27, starts at a value of 100. If you take that S&P 500 total return divided by gold, and or gold divided by the S&P 500, it's down to 2 now. But the key theme is it was about 1%. It's just gold has been stable versus the S&P 500 total return for since 1997. So almost 30 years. That's the longest period in history. After 1928, it was about 21 years. After 1969, it was around 21 years. So it's just the thing I'm worried about is this trend in gold I'm showing right here. The price of this is what I'm showing the opposite S&P 500 divided by gold heading higher is potentially going to kick up. And I'm really concerned that number one theme is gold is just up too much. And the key theme I want to our listeners and our viewers and myself and you to remember is when gold gets exciting, investors should be cautious. Two examples in history, the last time that gold got as exciting as it is now, meaning its 260-day volatility ran 2.2 times S&P 500, which is where it was right now, was 2007. It was probably a good time to be getting caution in the stock market in 1980. Another time was right before a significant recession. So gold exciting is when investors should be cautious. Now, that hasn't happened yet. I mean, the stock market is still doing fine, but I'm really concerned that what happened recently, 100-day correlation between gold and the S&P 500 reached its highest ever. It's like 0.62 versus the S&P 500. And that's because it was trickling down. But what I show you on this chart is, looks like to me, a chart that's readily just to turn right back up. S&P 500 divided by gold. And what's the number one way to make this turn up? Is thing remember is probably the S&P 500 going down, which means it brings everything down, gold just less. So here's a measure and lessons of correlated assets. Right now, when you have beta, and beta in the planet's S&P 500, gold right now trades 2 times the volatility and it's highly correlated. Virtually never in the history of mankind have we had declines in beta, maybe 5-10%, maybe somewhat volatile, with highly volatile, highly correlated assets not going down more. And that's what I'm concerned about. It's a stock puppet right now, gold is. But one key thing also that's happened in gold is I mentioned how high the volatility is, how we're supposed to be very careful when gold gets exciting. Investors should be cautious. But gold is also the highest, or the U.S. Treasury bond market is also the lowest versus gold since 1987. Now, this is not just the Treasury. This is the Treasury bond index we have in the Bloomberg Terminal since 1973. It just shows you what I'm worried about is just a little bit of mean reversion in the stock market. Takes everything down. The whole tide goes out, and there's only one thing left. We've already had the big pump and dump in Bitcoin and crypto. We've had a big pump then dump in gold. I think it put in a pretty enduring peak this year. Last year was the best year ever for gold in a non-inflation environment. And to me, there's only one thing left is that long bond at 5.25%. If I'm going to be proven wrong on that, we got to at least see how it goes through the end of the year because I've been wrong on that one for a few years.
Mm-hmm. So does that same type of mean reversion and, let's say, market behavior extend to silver, or do you see silver as more of an industrial commodity?
It is. Well, first of all, leverage gold, $66 an ounce. What silver's high this year was kind of thing that will typically put in peaks for decades, if history's a guide. It got its highest ever versus crude oil, its highest ever versus copper in Q1. There was just a gift to sell above 100. I still think 100's going to last for resistance for potentially a decade. But the difference is silver in the past, as we know, Spanish piece, piezo de ocho, piece of eight. I mean, it's been historically money, but now it's industrial metal. And it's very much, I'm seeing the same bucket as copper, but it's also the devil's metal for a reason and 2 times the volatility of gold. So it's still the same problem. But the key thing that's happened this year is we've had pumps and dumps and started with Bitcoin, gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and iron ore. Is copper going to follow that? But they all got just too expensive. And I point out what happened is when you get to 2 times your 60-month moving average, when you get to 2 times, which was the highest since 1980, when you get to 2 times your 10-year moving average, which is the highest since 1980, and things like gold and silver, that's the hardest thing for people to do sometimes is to sell when they're yelling. And those peaks could last forever, or for not ever, for a long time. So I'm really worried we're going to do what normally does. We'll be stuck in enduring ranges in gold and silver for an elongated period of time. They'll get us very bullish near the peaks and get us nearly bearish near the bottoms and put some levels on it, starting with gold. The long-term moving average from gold around $3,000 an ounce. Just point out the fact, 60-month, 10-year, what's it take to get there? Stock market is probably part of it, unfortunately. Silver, long-term moving average around $30 an ounce. We all know 50 is key support. But what happened with crude oil in 2008? It put in that high that still holds. Probably, I think, will happen. We're going to look back at from the future of gold, silver, platinum, palladium, what happened this year in Q1.
Just a quick aside for listeners here. I have been trying to remain listener supported here. So if you go to Substack, there's going to be a new section for subscribers only where we have a bonus section or bonus round of questions from every interview that's available to Substack subscribers. Please go check it out. It's $12 a month or $120 a year you can join for, which works out to $10 a month. I really want to remain independent, and this, of course, helps us continue with the show and continue to remain independent. Short of that, please like, subscribe, share the show. We're almost at 10,000 subscribers on YouTube. I really appreciate the support. Thank you, everyone.